Governor Eric Holcomb reinstates limited COVID restrictions. Those restrictions don't apply to churches. Plus, we talk Victoria Spartz's win in the 5th District and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending November 13th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb announced he will reimpose some COVID-19 restrictions on counties failing to control spread of the virus. Holcomb's new executive order comes after weeks of inaction in the face of worsening COVID numbers. The state will use the color-coded COVID map it updates weekly to determine what restrictions counties face. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box explains.
If your county is in orange, social gatherings of any kind, indoors or outdoors, are limited to 50 people. If your county is in red, social gatherings of any kind, indoors or outdoors, are limited to 25 people.
But those restrictions don't appear to apply to businesses, churches, or schools, and local health departments can still approve events that exceed those gathering limits, including sporting events. Holcomb says the state will be more active in urging businesses to enforce mask wearing, including posting signs about face coverings. But it's unclear how extensive that enforcement will be.
The ATC, et cetera, Homeland Security, will continue to take the posture and approach of education in terms of promoting the best practices.
The seven-day average for new COVID cases has increased more than 400% since Holcomb moved to reopening stage 5 in late September. Should the governor have reinstated restrictions weeks ago? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, why wait until now?
Oh, you think it might have something to do with November the 3rd? I mean, it's obvious what he was doing. He's like all other Republican officials. He's paralyzed with fear of the right wing of his own political party. And he was willing to risk the health and, in some cases, the lives of Hoosiers in order to make sure that the wrath of the right wing of the Republican Party wouldn't come down on him on Election Day. It's really kind of unconscionable. And it's also demonstrated. I mean, look at Monroe County. They put teeth behind the mask wearing mandate, and it's made a difference. Eric Holcomb won't do that. And it isn't surprising that they're getting mixed messages from people out there. If they listen to that person who's in the White House, it's behind us, it's in the rearview mirror, anybody who wears a mask is a wimp, on and on and on, and you don't hear one word of criticism out of Governor Holcomb's mouth about that. You don't hear one word where he says, you have to wear a mask, and we're going to enforce the mask mandate, and we're going to make sure that those groups don't meet. You don't hear that, because he has no leadership ability at all.
Mike O'Brien, I've heard this theory that Ann promoted about it was the election that is the reason that Holcomb didn't reimpose some of these restrictions earlier. And I don't understand that, because he was always going to win, probably in a landslide, which is exactly what he did. So if we discount that as the reason, why wait until now when things have gotten really bad to reimpose these limited restrictions?
The most popular political choice he could have made if he was only looking at this through a political lens would have been on October 15th to repeal the mask mandate. Polling was starting to cut against him. The margin wasn't necessarily shrinking, but it was clear that the Libertarian candidate for governor, who opposed vocally any kind of mask restriction or requirement or recommendation at all, was moving up in the polls, was in double digits. Governor's numbers were coming down. And if he wanted to make a decision that was playing to the right wing of the party, he repeals the mask mandate on October 15th, three or four weeks before the election. And and it's the most popular thing he could have done. And he didn't do it. Now, we are seeing numbers go up across the country. I mean, you could point the finger at him fairly. If you looked around the country, and we were the only ones who hadn't done anything a month ago or didn't reinstitute lockdowns a month ago. The whole country is moving this direction, and they're doing it right now because the numbers are tracking the same everywhere. There's not one place you can point to in the country, whether they are completely locked down like Chicago or California, or have had lighter restrictions in place now for some time like Indiana, that aren't going case for case in terms of new restrictions. So I think and the rate of positive cases. So there's the whole country is moving in this direction at the same time. Fairly. Does politics play into this at all? Of course it does, because what's politics in its nature? It's the public's reaction to a decision you've made that they don't like. And that is what we're dealing with here.
He was trying to straddle the line.
The public does not want these restrictions back in place. They do not want to be locked down again.
John
Schwannis, I want to ask you this question, which is to Mike's point, and Dr. Box talked about this Wednesday, that we're hearing more and more reports from health officials across the state that, quite frankly, people are tired of the disease, they're tired of the pandemic, they're tired of any sort of guidelines or restrictions. So if that's all true, then will any of these restrictions make any difference?
I don't know. We can certainly stipulate that people are tired of having life-altering safeguards. They're tired of this disease. They're tired of the drama and the trauma that comes from this disease. But so what? It's still here. And we're not controlling our fate or the calendar. It's the disease. It is COVID-19 that is in the driver's seat. So we can be tired all we want. We can grouse all we want. But I guess public health, common sense as well, would dictate that if we all did follow basic safeguards, as much as we don't like it and as unpleasant as it is, certainly during a holiday season to boot, if we did those things, we probably could get rid of this quicker. Now, we do have the vaccines apparently in the offing, so maybe that will be the silver bullet. But in this case, what's popular and what makes sense from a public health standpoint may diverge, actually.
Yeah. Nikki Kelly, I want to ask you the answer to the question of what will these restrictions matter lies somewhat in enforcement, of course. And it wasn't entirely clear Wednesday what that would look like, but the executive order, the actual wording of it, just came out. Did we get any more clarity in that executive order?
Well, I mean, enforcement is really the ball game, right? So unless people feel like they're going to be in trouble somehow, a lot of people aren't going to follow it. But yeah, I mean, there is definitely wording in the order that is more specific to state and local entities issuing verbal warnings, then cease orders, and then possibly shutting down businesses. So that's in there, but some of it's discretionary, obviously. So we'll see how, I guess, stringent, the entities, the organizations, state government and local health officials are in pushing those.
Yeah, where the rubber meets the road. All right, well, Governor Eric Holcomb's latest round of COVID restrictions, like many that came before, do not apply to houses of worship, despite state officials highlighting churches as a major source of the virus's spread. Holcomb says his newest executive order, which imposes social gathering limits in counties experiencing high rates of spread, does not put those restrictions on worship spaces in those counties.
But we do want to stress that this virus connects with people wherever they are when you let your guard down.
State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says she has respect and support for church services.
I would say that of the top four or five contact tracing events that we have, there is a spike every week on Sunday related to church events.
Box urges people in high-risk categories, older Hoosiers and those with underlying health conditions like heart disease and diabetes, to worship remotely if possible. Mike O'Brien, does any of this work? Can we hope to get COVID under control if we're not addressing what Dr. Box says is one of the major causes of its spread? Hey, Mike, can you hear me?
Can you hear me? I'm sorry. My internet seems to be cutting off.
No worries. Mike, I was just asking, how do we hope to get this virus under control, at least its spread under control, if we're not addressing what Dr. Box says is one of the major sources of its spread?
Well, I don't think you are. Virus is not particularly cared, to her point, whether or not you are in a bar, in a packed bar or a packed church. The people are willing to take, we saw in the spring, is they're going to continue to go to church and and in some cases, in spite of, directly in spite of what the government's suggesting they do.
Yeah. And Delaney, to that point, is it really within Governor Holcomb's power to force churches to shut down to in-person services?
Yes, it is. It is, and it ought to be. And, you know, for those of us who have been going to church remotely for months, okay, there are ways to participate in a church service on a Sunday. He does, again, he's like every other Republican elected official, paralyzed by the right wing of his party. And if he's seen as anti-church, even if it's not only common sense, it is absolutely mandated to stand up there and say, we respect your religion, we respect your desire to go to a house of worship on Sunday, but you can't do it. Because when you do it and you get infected, you spread that infection to other people. And it is not only not patriotic, it is exactly the antithesis of why you go to church. Because you're supposed to help care for others. And by going to church and spreading the virus, you're not doing that. And if he had any leadership potential at all, he'd stand up there and say that. But what he says is, it's okay to go to churches in large numbers. He's telling them it's okay to do. And then it's not surprising that people do it. And it's not surprising that the infection continues to spread. It's all lack of any kind of leadership.
Well, I don't think he's saying that people should go to church in large numbers, but he's not stopping them from doing
that.
Well,
he's saying it's okay to do.
He's asking them not to, but not telling them not to. Nikki, we just asked the question in the last segment about will these restrictions work, and we talked about enforcement being really the ball game here. But even if enforcement is really robust, even if we get it under control in businesses and the like, if we're not getting it under control everywhere, does any of it matter?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one. And I actually think it's really interesting to watch this play out because, you know, I think the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which we passed a couple of years ago, is coming into play here. It requires governments, you know, to try to affect things in the least restrictive manner. And ever since Attorney General Curtis Hill came out really pushing against these things, because originally churches were indeed impacted by these rules. And so I think Governor Holcomb backed off, and I think there's probably a legal question, although for a court to decide.
John Schwanis, with that question out there unanswered potentially forever, unless there is legal action, and you kind of referenced this in the last segment, are we just kind of holding on with our, you know, holding on as best we can until there's an effective vaccine that's widely available?
To a certain extent, Brandon, I'd say that's the case. I would suggest that there is some legal precedent here. In the past 6 months or so, certainly during this period of coronavirus, the crisis in which we're in, there was a case that went to the Supreme Court out of California that involved the ability of churches to remain open and have in-person services despite orders prohibiting it. Now, the reason I say it's largely analogous is I haven't read the opinion lately, and I can't recall if it was Gavin Newsom, the governor, who had imposed the ban, or whether it was a local, some sort of health official. And certainly some states would treat those as somewhat distinct, whether it's a health official or a governor. The other caveat, which is even bigger, is if memory serves, it was a 5-4 decision from the U.S. Supreme Court with Ruth Bader Ginsburg voting in majority. So I'll leave it to your interpretation or imagination as to how that might differ, if it does differ, if it were to go to the court now.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should COVID gathering limits be imposed on houses of worship? A, yes, or B, no. Last week, we asked you if the Indiana Democratic Party is still relevant at the statewide level. 67% of you say yes, just 33% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Republican Victoria Spartz is going to Congress after emerging the victor in Indiana's 5th Congressional District, one of the most closely watched U.S. House races this cycle. WFYI's Jill Sheridan reports.
Washington, D.C., after a close contest against Democrat Christina Hale. The race took more than a day to call. She says when she came here from the Ukraine 20 years ago, she would never have imagined this future.
But I believe this is the beauty of our republic.
Spartz, a former accountant and business owner, will take up her new position in January. She'll join a relatively young freshman class that adds more women to the ranks of Congress. Spartz says she's ready to get over politics and start working on policy. She says she'll try to do that with whoever ends up in the White House.
There is a lot of talk about we'll be bipartisan, and so we'll see. We may be, you know, people will try to put their money where mouth is. You know, we'll see. We'll try.
Spartz says she supports limited and efficient government and that affordable health care is a top priority.
Nikki Kelly, this is quite an incredible trajectory for Spartz, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, look, you gotta give it to her. She has taken the hardest route to this. You know, she did she won a 7-way caucus to even get her Senate seat. She then, you know, serves for 3 years, gets through a 10-person primary, and then manages to win in the general despite being outraised. So I think if there's one thing you can say, that she maybe likes the underdog situation, and she's clearly a hard campaigner, and now we'll get to see how she acts in Congress.
As the race got closer to Election Day, I think a lot of folks started to suspect that Christina Hale, the Democrat, would emerge the victor in that race. I think that was everybody on the show predicted that except for Jennifer Hollowell. Mike O'Brien texted me his predictions as I requested, and he had picked, I believe, Christina Hale to win that seat. So, John, was this maybe the most surprising result in Indiana on Election Day?
I thought it was certainly up there on the list of surprises. I was among those, as you point out, who thought Christina Hale would win. I thought because of the demographic shifts in that district and the much-discussed concern that suburbia generally around the country and suburban women have had with the Trump administration and the backlash in terms of their view of this election as something of a referendum on the Trump presidency and his leadership, I thought that Christina Hale would prevail. So she didn't, and she lost by a margin that actually, surpassed what I might have imagined. Don't know why, don't know what was at work here, but I'd say that was certainly a contender for one of the biggest surprises on Election Day.
Mike O'Brien, we've been talking about this district and this race for a couple years now as it looked to get a little more purple, and it still might be that, but what are you expecting out of Victoria Spartz in the way that she governs as a U.S. House member? She is very conservative, unapologetically so, in a district that doesn't quite look quite that conservative, but she won, so does she follow through on everything that she would have promised in that sense?
Well, if we look at her, she was only in the legislature for 3 years, as Nikki said, but she worked a lot during those 3 years. She didn't sit around and just kind of like try to figure the place out. I mean, she jumped in on some big issues, picked off healthcare in particular, and had a passion for that and a passion for, you know, figuring out how to get those costs down and spend a lot of time on those issues. So I think you're not going to see her shy away from kind of jumping right in and getting to work in Congress. I think to John's question kind of recapped in terms of the theory going in with suburban women and it being a moderate district, maybe it was ready to turn purple. I don't think those dynamics didn't play themselves out. I think when you have a margin like Donald Trump had and Eric Holcomb had at the top of the ticket, in a district like that, it's really hard to overcome those numbers by flipping moderate, suburban people who had traditionally voted Republican. The turnout was so high, you just didn't have the math there. Christina Hale ran a great campaign. It was obviously well-funded. But you just can't get, it's still a pretty red state. And if you're putting up those kind of numbers at the top of the ballot, it's really hard to flip a seat that's on the margin down ballot.
And Eleni, theoretically, this is another this is something the Democrats try to go out for in 2 years and 4 years. But it's also possible, even likely, that this district will look very, very different 2 years from now after the legislature redraws all of the district maps. Yes?
Oh, yes. I'm sure that'll be the case. But you know, I, to Mike's point, I think there's a certain amount of validity to that. And that is, you know, that you had people that went out. Victoria Spartz, to give her credit, did a very good job of distancing herself from Donald Trump. In the primary, she was wrapped around him with both arms. She was more of a Trump than Trump. And in the general election, she stayed completely away from using his name, which was probably smart in that district. In addition, she tried to talk about health care. Well, you know, we know she voted against covering pre-existing conditions. And I hope she is going to reflect that district. And if she's going to reflect that district, she's going to strengthen Obamacare and the ACA and hopefully work for a pro-choice agenda and not be a poster child for the National Rights Association. If she is going to be true to her word and try to represent everybody in that district, she's going to have to moderate her stances on a number of those issues. And if she doesn't, it's going to be a different ballgame when you don't have a gubernatorial race in there and you don't have a presidential race in there, and the focus is much more on that race than it would have been in 2020.
All right, well, Indianapolis Democrat Greg Taylor is the new Indiana Senate Minority Leader, becoming the first black leader of a legislative caucus in state history. Senate Democrats almost completely overhauled their leadership team. In a statement, Taylor says the pandemic has pulled back the curtain on how far behind Indiana is on protecting workers and the right to vote and ensuring a fair justice system. He says the Democratic caucus will continue to champion those causes. Republican Senate leader Roderick Bray congratulated Taylor. In a statement, Bray says he looks forward to working with the new leader, whom he calls a, quote, relentless advocate. Senate Democrats also chose a new assistant minority leader, minority caucus chair, and assistant caucus chair. John Schwanes, how significant is it that Greg Taylor is the first black leader of a state legislative caucus?
I think that is significant. When you think that in our history as a state, we've always had a caucus leadership be white males, occupied by white males. And now you have a situation where you have somebody breaking a barrier, if you will. We still have women still need to break that barrier as well. But
Vi Simpson broke that barrier for women, I think.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I take it back. First African-American, though. So it is. Now, I would say that it would be even more meaningful. We'll put significance aside for a minute. It would be more meaningful if you had a caucus of more than 11 out of 50, because as a political reality, regardless of who is in that seat, you're still facing a supermajority on the other side. So there's only so much you can do. But let's put that practicality aside and celebrate a victory for diversity.
Yeah, I actually, Nikki, John got ahead of my question to you, which was because of the functional inability of Democrats to do much in the Indiana Senate when they're in a superminority, is its significance more symbolic than practical?
Well, you got to start somewhere, right? And frankly, I'm shocked it took till 2020 to get, you know, a minority leader. So good for him. I think some fresh ideas are a good idea. And the only thing I think is he'll have to do a little more listening than talking, which is kind of what Greg Taylor is known for.
Yeah, I look forward to those press conferences with the Indiana Senate Democratic Caucus because they are, as one colleague said after this announcement, I will have to make sure I have enough batteries for those for my recorder. But Mike O'Brien, are you a little surprised at Democrats overhauling almost entirely their leadership team?
I don't know the story on that, so I don't know if it was just Tim Lannon, who had served in that position for a long time, was ready to step aside, or what the I don't know the internal politics of how that all went down. But Greg Taylor's clearly always been he's been the most outspoken person in that caucus, and it doesn't have, and you always know where you stand with him and where he stands on issues, and so I don't expect that to change. It was an obvious direction for that caucus to go. I do like that in Indiana we don't, you know, the minority in Indiana, and this has been true even when it's been closer, does try to participate in the process and doesn't just try to make it political so they can catch another seat and look two cycles away and try to figure out how to be relevant again. They do get engaged on a policy level, and we've seen a lot of positive examples, Christina Hale being one of them, that passed a lot of legislation from the minority.
Yeah, I liked Senator Bray's comment that Greg Taylor is a relentless advocate. You can take that two ways, but I mean, there is, I think that's a great description of him. And Delaney, should we expect things to be very different from that caucus with a very new leadership team with Greg Taylor at its head?
I think he will articulate, as Senator Bray said, he will articulate those issues that are very important to him and go forward with it. It's difficult with gerrymandering the way it is to have a relevant voice there. So, and with social media and everything else after this next redistricting, I think it's not going to get an awful lot better, I'm afraid, because the Republicans and the computers are masters at gerrymandering districts.
Well, that'll be something to watch.
Miss the old days when Democrats used to gerrymander on paper.
Yeah,
pencil and paper. That's the way it should be
done.
That's right.
I will say something. It did strike me as funny that the Indiana Senate Democratic Caucus overhauled its leadership team despite gaining a member, and the House Democratic Caucus, despite losing four members, stayed relatively the same. But that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.